Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Cortland Dahl, Senior Research Scientist at the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has studied and practiced meditation during his travels through Asia, and at a point in his life spent 8 years living in a Tibetan refugee settlement in Nepal. He is the co-founder and executive director of Theragar International, that is a global network of meditation groups. And he's the lead content creator, also known as the chief contemplative officer for the Healthy Minds app-based program, which I hope we can focus on in this conversation. Welcome, Dr. Dahl.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And I've been using the app. It's a great app. I found it very usable, and I thought it's an opportunity for us to just explore the app-based technology as you have seen it and you have developed it during the several years, and you can take me to the history of that. So let's talk about your experience. You know, you have this really unique experience, heavy duty meditation, traveling the world, living in these very unique environments, and then coming into, you know, in the West, now we're transitioning into apps and using apps. Like, can you string that together for me? How does that all come together?
Yeah, it's a great question. And on the face of it, it probably must seem like a very circuitous route from, you know, living in Asia to building an app. Let's see, what's the short version? You know, when so I've always had an interest in science and research. Back when I was just getting my undergrad degree, I worked in a lab back at that time. This is in the early 90s. And I was in a lab actually studying complex skill acquisition and intelligence, so nothing having to do with meditation. But even at the time, I was interested in the research on meditation, and I wrote a review paper as a, you know, a sophomore or something back in the day. So I've always had this interest. And then my life went into, you know, a very different direction. I went over to Asia, as you said, got into this very geeky side of the world's contemplative traditions. I learned Tibetan. I was actually translating these ancient meditation manuals, which I still have a passion for. So kind of whatever I do, I tend to completely geek out on it. So I was sort of doing that with the, you know, these meditative traditions.
And what sent you there, Cortland? Like, how'd you get involved in that? It seems like an interesting direction. You were in a lab. Now you're going to the other side of the world. Now you're like really focused on this particular emphasis in meditation training. What took you there?
Well, what really took me there was my own interest in meditation. I started at that same time I was getting interested in science. I had really intense anxiety, actually, when I was just starting college, you know, like kind of the low grade anxiety of my teenage years just kind of got unmanageable. And I was really stressed out. You know, I had a total phobia of public speaking. I remember just being terrified giving presentations in class, which is funny because I do public speaking all the time now. I never would have guessed that back in the day. So I was really just looking for something, for anything to help with my own mind and emotions and just to manage my own inner world. And I stumbled upon the practice of meditation. It completely changed my life. You know, in a matter of 6 months, I was like, wow, this is just so powerful. So that just set me off on a course where both in my personal life, but also my professional life, this is just what I wanted to learn more about and understand and practice myself. So that's how it all got started. And of course, led eventually around the world and back to now scientific laboratories and building an app.
And in the development of that app, like, when did you start getting involved in the creation of this app in particular? And then in your particular style, because I've been reviewing this app and listening to it, you have your style, your take. So let's go through that.
Well, when I decided to go back to grad school, I was not, you know, the traditional path. I was in my mid-30s when I decided to go and get a PhD. And I had met Richie Davidson, who you know, and, you know, who's one of the leading scientists in the scientific study of well-being and the scientific research on meditation. So I met Richie actually at a conference in Zurich a long time ago, and he said, why don't you come to Madison? And I said to him, why would I go to Madison? And he's uniquely persuasive. I ended up, you know, coming here for a visit and just have stayed. I did my PhD under his guidance and have worked at the Center for Healthy Minds ever since. And initially, when to kind of loop this back to the app, it really started with research questions we had. At that time, the research on mindfulness was really starting to take shape. And we were talking about researching other forms of meditation. And we kind of think of meditation almost like exercise. There are many forms of meditation, and they do different things for your mind, and as it turns out, for your brain and even your physiology, in the same way that different forms of exercise have different functions. And the world was very, or the scientific research was very focused on mindfulness. And we thought, well, how can we crack this open a bit and broaden the scientific agenda? So it started with that. And as part of my PhD, I actually wrote the curriculum for what is now the Healthy Minds program and the Healthy Minds app. So it started there. It started with this well-being framework that we developed and subsequently published. And all the things just came together, again, first driven by the research. But then we just started getting so much interest from individuals, from organizations, from companies, from all different sectors that were seeing the research that was coming out of the center and just saying, hey, how can we actually benefit from this? Like, do you have any tools? Do you have anything to offer? And so our interest in the research coincided with all of that incoming interest. And we decided, why not just build something to put it out in the world? And then we can even research that and see what we learn.
And did your building of the, so you developed the curriculum, and then at some point, and this is when you're still at the university, this became some kind of collaboration with a business entity? Or how do you like bring this thing to scale? It's so pretty. I look at the app. Is there a co-developer here? How do you make it work in that way?
It's a very non-traditional way that this came about. Right at the time we were having these conversations and I was working on my dissertation, Richie Davidson, again, the neuroscientist who's behind the Center for Healthy Minds, he decided to create a nonprofit that would be affiliated with the center, still kind of affiliated with the university and the Center for Healthy Minds. So he set up this whole nonprofit that basically has the mission of translating the research into tools, to practical tools to help people measure and cultivate well-being. So that's basically what this organization does, Healthy Minds Innovations. So Healthy Minds Innovations is the entity that really allowed us to build the app. It's in the same building. I mean, people like, you know, me and Richie and a few others work actually both for the nonprofit and the university. So it's very closely aligned, and it's basically just meant to bring the research out into the world. And then this really cool loop where actually we can then take that collaboration and use it to generate tons of data that can feed back into the research, which is exactly what's happening. I mean, we're doing research in schools and organizations with individuals, just all these cool settings that wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't formed that nonprofit as well.
Yeah. And kudos to you for that. I mean, it's so hard to get the research into practice, and you've done it. And sometimes it's that medium that's so hard. Like, how do you make something nicely usable? And you all were able to do that. I like many things about the app itself, the interface, the usage of meditation that shows the time, and you can go back and forward in 15-second intervals, pausing and talking to people like Richie Davidson about the research. There's so many ways in which make it unique. And maybe you could talk about some of those ways. What do you like about, you know, a curriculum person, which I am too, because I love developing classes, usually in the research environment. And it's just like, you want to take ownership of the thing. You want it to work like just right. You want it to get across and really ring true. So what's your approach as a curriculum developer to make that kind of stuff happen?
Yeah. Well, like you, it sounds like I love creating learning experiences for people, and I love really seeing how things affect people and what's working, what's not working. You know, at a certain point when you're doing this kind of work, you develop a pretty thick skin for critical feedback. So now, I don't say it was like this at the beginning, but now I even love hearing the negative feedback, because I always feel like that's where, you know, you can detect the patterns and sense the opportunities to make it even more impactful. You know, when we first started out on this path, it was clear the world does not need another mindfulness app. You know, there were already some really great offerings out there. We didn't want to just reinvent the wheel. So we were really interested in kind of pushing the dialogue and the scientific agenda further and building a tool that not only hopefully would help people, but would give researchers powerful ways to investigate important scientific questions. So for example, you know, one of the things that we were wondering and talking about is there's this whole movement really to make these practices more accessible, to make it easier for people to do them if you're learning to meditate or you're learning mindfulness or other forms of meditation. And we wanted to investigate that, you know, how much is gained and lost in that, you know, attempt to make them more accessible. So in the app, which you will have seen, any of the practices you can do either as a sitting meditation, or you can do the exact same practice, but as an active meditation. So they're actually designed and scripted to be done while you're going for a walk or doing the laundry or something like that. And we actually, you know, we did that because we actually didn't know, but we wanted to find out what would happen. Would they still have the same impact on people? Would they benefit people? So we're actively researching that. And so far, the data is showing that actually they can be just as impactful as the sitting meditations, for instance. Similarly, in the app, we have both podcast-style lessons, which are more teaching the deeper principles behind meditation practice and what some of the research says. But also, we have, of course, the guided meditation. So there, too, we're doing studies on this. So we can see what happens when somebody just does those lessons, but they don't do the meditation practice, or vice versa. So a lot of this is just driven by our own curiosity and the questions we have as scientists, and the intention of hopefully just making something that will just with each iteration be more and more helpful and beneficial for the people who use it. So that's kind of it's our kind of curiosity that's driving the whole thing, I would say. And so we've been fortunate just to work with a lot of really amazing people and designers and you know, people who have supported the whole endeavor. And we chose to make it completely free at a certain point, which was I think a really important decision, but also not easy because, of course, these things are not cheap to build. So how do you make it sustainable? And yeah, it's been a whole adventure and learning journey for us as well.
Yeah, I want to reemphasize that. Yeah, freely available app here. And I want to cover all the bases, make sure I covered it all about what the app includes. So there are the didactic materials to teach people about what some of these core concepts are if you're going to be practicing meditation. Then there are the guided meditation that you lead. There's meditations you lead, and usually a timer is associated with this, and you can go back and forward as you need. You have interviews, brief interviews, and podcast type conversations with folks, usually about the science surrounding this type of work. In addition, and I sent this to a friend today, after you complete a practice, and say you're doing like a gratitude practice, and you've had someone in mind, and at the end of each practice, it seems like I can share something about the lesson by a text or email to someone else, which I've done. So did I cover all the bases there? Do you want to elaborate on any of those things? And am I missing anything?
No, that was a great summary. And, you know, a few things to pick up on. The last piece you mentioned is something we're really, really excited about, which is this idea of micro interventions or micro supports, which we oftentimes call them, which is really the whole idea is simple things that take little or no time out of your day, like a guided meditation would, but which might have a really important effect in just shifting how you experience a given activity or interaction. So for example, like you know, you sent that little note to somebody, like one of the first ones you'll see if you're in the app is just a little message about the gift of attention. So whoever you're with, you know, the next person you see, just give them your full attention like you're giving them a gift and just see what happens. Try to be fully present, you know, for the people who you're interacting with. And then we can actually test that, like those little prompts, those little nudges. It doesn't take anybody any time. I mean, just, you know, to read a couple sentences. But yet, if you actually do that, these things we know scientifically can have quite an important impact in people's experience. So that's one of the frontiers for us, is how to use technology to prompt people to take these very, very small steps that cumulatively can add up to a large impact on mental health and well-being. The other thing to pick up on is the underpinnings for this whole program, which is this a new scientific framework for well-being that we worked on for many years and that I mentioned earlier, which is really a different way of thinking about mental and emotional well-being. A lot of the influential conceptions of well-being in the scientific literature are not really focused on learning. It's just kind of you have these dimensions or you don't, and you can look at all these correlations and associations, But we were very interested in what are the core dimensions of well-being that we can see from empirical research are trainable, and even from a biological point of view, exhibit some sort of training-induced plasticity, for example, in the brain. So we focus on four, what we call the four pillars of well-being in this framework, all of which are central for mental health and emotional well-being, and all of which have a lot of data and research indicating that they're trainable and that the training is even easier than we oftentimes think. So the whole program is really built on this way of thinking about well-being and these four pillars, which we can talk about if it's helpful. And that's actually a really important piece of what we're doing, because we're not only developing these training tools like the practices and lessons you mentioned, but we're also developing a lot of scientific measures that will help us measure these dimensions of well-being. So researchers, again, can use them in their work. And, you know, people out in the world can also use them just to measure their own well-being, to get a snapshot of what's going on in their own mind and mental health.
And yeah, I do want to talk about those pillars. I have one question that came to mind when we were talking about the elements of the app. Given that you have that global network of meditation groups, has your group, or have you all thought about like tracking location and then trying to connect location to where those sitting groups would be? So it could be you have the app and you have the option for in-person if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, so as you mentioned, I've been also very involved in creating this global meditation, this global community of meditation groups and centers around the world. And that's where a lot of my experience in learning how to meditate and teaching meditation comes from, the work I've done there. And, you know, we have definitely thought about using technology and even, you know, GPS and things like that to look at location in relationship to well-being. It hasn't been so much in relationship to that community of meditation groups and centers, but looking at what role place has on our own well-being. And it could be not only geographic, but even, you know, are you at home versus at work versus outside versus indoors, all these variations in where we are physically, and looking at the relationship between that and well-being. And similarly, how being in different places in different times might make you more or less open to doing simple things to cultivate well-being. You know, if you're like in a super busy work day, it might be hard to take that time, but like we like to think of moments of transition in particular as being little windows where you might be able to do something simple, one of these micro interventions or micro supports. So physical location, movement, all of these things actually gets at another area we're super interested in, which is how we can use all the passive streams of data that are coming in through our watches, our phones, all these different things, and use them to help sense the opportunities for people to take steps like the ones that we've been talking about. So anyways, there's a lot to unpack, and your kind of question makes me kind of opens a bit of a Pandora's box of all sorts of different things we're kind of interested in. But that's just a kind of a quick summary of some of the things we're thinking about.
Well, and I'm really interested in the last point of what you were saying about tracking data. And maybe we should talk about this just for a couple minutes, because as we both probably know, we rely a lot on self-report of people's practice time. And for many, many years, actually for decades now, like to really capture what we would say the behavior of meditation is and how much is happening, it's a really hard thing to measure, like really hard. And the field would really benefit from getting that measure so we could say, oh, the person is actually meditating in response to the stimulus provided in our interventions. This is the dose. It's either adequate or it's not to some degree. And this is really the defining independent variable to whatever these outcomes we're interested in. So how close can we get? I always want to know how close with technology, because people have been telling me about Fitbit. We're going to capture these 50 different metrics. Can it hone us in on exactly that dose of meditation that someone is getting? And that, now I'm putting on a nerdy research cap, but we really need to know this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the simple answer is, you know, we don't yet know that, but I think we're getting close to having the the tools where we can start figuring that out. We just did a, you know, our first dosage study, and it was a very simple one of just looking at, you know, is there a discernible difference if people do 10 minutes twice a day versus 20 minutes once a day? And actually we found that we didn't find a real difference there, but there's all sorts of questions beyond that, you know, doing just short practices versus longer practices. One study, one RCT we did with 700 school employees showed that just 4.5 minutes of practice a day for just a month had all of these quite dramatic impacts on things like depression, anxiety, perceived stress, and even other things like social connectedness, just how, you know, supported people feel and connected people feel to the people in their lives. So there's a lot we don't know. I mean, what we're doing in the realm of measurement is, again, we have these four pillars of well-being, which are awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. These four things are kind of the four pillars of well-being that I mentioned. And we're developing what we think of as kind of four categories of measures that can get at those. So as you mentioned, like the most common one, and there's already a lot of measures for these, are self-report measures, so short questionnaires. But in addition, we're also developing gamified behavioral measures. So almost they feel like little simple games you're playing, but they might be measuring something like sustained attention or empathy, you know, again, things related to these four pillars of awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. The third one that we're looking at is sort of in the moment questions. So what we call experience sampling, which I'm sure you're aware of, you know, where you might just be going about your day and you just get a little question on your watch, which might say, hey, are you paying attention to what you're doing right now? So it's not asking you, do you generally pay attention? It's asking right now with what you're doing, are you or are you not paying attention? Or do you not right now feel connected to the people around you or the people in your life? So it's more of a snapshot of what's going on in the moment versus some kind of global statement. And then the last one, which is sort of the holy grail and is much harder, but we're working towards, is how to use all that passive data to put that all together and in conversation with these other measurements. So we might even be able to use machine learning and AI to say, you know, we can tell from, you know, the GPS data we're getting from your phone and maybe your accelerometer that says as you're moving or not, and maybe like text recognition that can detect language patterns and the messages you're sending, and put all of that together and say, hey, you know, you really seem to be experiencing a very high level of stress right now, or, oh, you're doing really, really well. So maybe pay attention to what's going on in your life that will bring more clarity to why you're flourishing in this moment. So we're not close to that right now, but we're trying to put the pieces in place where we can help people better understand their well-being using this incredibly rich field of data that we're all surrounded by.
Yeah, I like that piece about like noticing when you're flourishing. This idea of like you can actually savor those things. Like you may be in a moment that's pretty good for you and it's not going to last very long because you're quickly going to become distracted by the next thing. So I like it. Let's talk about briefly the is anything lost? You know, we all have these conversations about what's lost through app use. Do you think anything, like I'll show you what you've argued in your previous work. So there's advantages over in-person delivery. We know that like cost is cheaper. We don't have to like have access to a teacher. We don't have to drive. We don't have to schedule. So the scalability idea is strong for apps. And so I think that's well known. 24 hours of access a day. So if someone is, you know, having problems sleeping in the middle of the night, you know, or early morning, you don't have to reach out and try to find a group. You can rely on the practices guided in the app, so it's useful for that. So the convenience thing is there. And then, as you said, you can like get sense data, you can capture data, ways in which in a group you're not going to really do that. So you can get some feedback as well. So those are at least a couple good things. There might be other things that you have that say that speak to it being even better than that. But then do you think anything is lost? I've asked some people about like the je ne sais quoi, like what is the piece of the in-group after you've seen so many groups? Is there a piece that's missing or not?
That's a hugely important question. And this too is one that we're really hoping to study scientifically. My sense as somebody who's, you know, been around a lot of, you know, I teach meditation and I've been around the world. I've been around in that kind of space of just seeing people trying to learn these things and how challenging it can be. My sense is there are real benefits to the technology and having these apps. And there are some real benefits that you don't get that you get from in-person training. Part of it is just, we are social creatures. We are wired for relationships. We learn socially. I mean, these days, so much emphasis is put on the information side of learning, and we've way over-indexed, my personal sense is, we've way over-indexed on the information versus the more embodied and social elements of learning. But if you look at young kids, the vast majority of what you learn is simply by observing and being around other people. So there's a real power to that. I mean, it's just, again, how we learn. A lot of the learning we do is through role modeling and interactions. And so it's not that that's completely removed with an app, but it's certainly not emphasizing that. And then there's practical things, like you can just ask a question if you're confused about something. You can get feedback about what's going on in your life. So there's elements like that, which, again, there's some apps that are trying to do something like that, where you can get a little bit of coaching in the app, but it's just different than just sitting there in the room. One very powerful thing that I've seen with the in-person element is just having other peers, other people who are there with you. And I remember, and in fact, I've had this experience many times, where you're sitting and you're learning to meditate. And I remember at the beginning looking around and seeing everybody else, and it seemed like everybody else was just having the greatest meditation. They seemed so peaceful and they're sitting there quietly. And I'm just thinking about my own experience, and my mind is just totally distracted. And like, my God, everybody else has this figured out. And I'm just, my mind is just a scattered mess right now. And then you have a conversation and you realize everybody's experiencing that. Everybody's distracted. Everybody's struggling. And just hearing that from other people is so reassuring. You just feel, oh, I'm not alone here. This is just the human mind. We're all trying to figure this out. We've all struggled with similar things. So I do think there are unique things to the in-person experience. And our aspiration is that through using our app and people using other apps like this, that it might open doors and help them develop a rich inner life where maybe, you know, to whatever degree they can, they take some steps to connect with other people or with these other experiences. But as you said, I think there are unique things to apps that the in-person experience doesn't give. And you listed a bunch of them. It's just so powerful to have this thing in your pocket where you can, you know, like I love to walk or jog, and then I can just put on a guided meditation and suddenly I'm meditating and jogging at the same time. Like, that's amazing. You know, you don't necessarily need an app to do that, but you can get guidance and listen to things that will inspire you. So I think there are some unique benefits on both sides. So ideally, I would say people might start with one versus the other. And ideally, in the long term, you probably work with both.
And this work, some of the work ended up being published. You and your group published in 2020. You had a randomized controlled trial here. You had two meditation groups, two active conditions, that you conceptualized as two families of meditations. You're trying to see if one was more relatively important than the other on some mental health outcomes versus a waitlist control. What did you find in that trial? Anything surprising to you and informative about next steps?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about that one and some of the other research we've done. So we're really blessed at the center to have some brilliant researchers and colleagues of mine who are taking the Healthy Minds program and putting it out in the world and just testing. So as I mentioned earlier, the framework has these four dimensions of well-being, of awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. And these are very different kinds of meditation. They're, you know, if you actually practice them, they're activating very different mechanisms in the mind. And even there's some evidence that the neural mechanisms, the actual networks in the brain that are activated when you do these practices are completely different. So we're really trying to look at, you know, through our research, how different do they have different effects on people? How do they work? Are they, you know, is the biology, you know, very different? And we've learned some interesting things. So in one study, the one you mentioned, we didn't actually pick up nearly as strong a signal as we thought in terms of the kind of differentiated one form of practice versus another. One challenge with this particular study is that the design we had for it, both groups or all the groups started with awareness practice, and then they kind of went into a slightly different practice from there. So they had this sort of common basis. It wasn't like one only did insight and one only did connection, say. So we had sort of a common sort of the beginning of the training actually was shared between them. And we think that might be a little bit of why we didn't find such differences. In subsequent research, you know, we've done other RCTs beyond that, and we've learned some really interesting things. Like I mentioned this work with school teachers that we did. In that study, again, we found some really robust effects on overall well-being, on improvements in depression, anxiety, social connection. I mentioned some of this stuff earlier. One of the cool things that we did as a follow-up on this study is we did what's called a mediation analysis, which basically is kind of looking at what is the active ingredient. Like we know, for example, that people who practiced 4 or 5 minutes a day for a month had these strong decreases in stress and anxiety, for instance. But what was it that was leading to that? Was it, for example, that they improved in their awareness or they improved their sense of connectedness? Or was it actually something else, not even related to these dimensions of well-being? So we actually measured these elements. And in this particular study, what we found is that all four dimensions of well-being improved, and that they all accounted for some of those improvements. They were all kind of synergistically together responsible for these improvements in stress and anxiety and so on. But what was especially cool was that the one that was far and away accounted for the biggest chunk was connection. And this, you know, ties into other really interesting research, you know, showing like about the toxic effects of loneliness, for example. And the research shows that there's almost an epidemic of loneliness, especially in the US and in other countries as well. And this is an incredibly powerful predictor, not only of mental and emotional well-being, but even physical health. A lot of people don't realize that loneliness is as toxic for physical health as smoking. And of course, your doctors never tell you this. You hardly ever hear about it, but the science is pretty strong to indicate that it is. So in any case, what was cool about this is it showed that not only can these practices improve well-being, but in this case, that it actually improved people's sense of feeling connected to others in their lives and feeling supported. And that in turn was what was accounting for a lot of these improvements in their overall well-being and decreasing these other issues like stress and so forth. So anyways, there's a lot of research we've done and I could totally geek out on the details, but we're learning some really, really cool things. Still way more questions than answers, but a lot that we're learning.
And these samples that you've studied from to date, what are we talking about? Normal, healthy adults. And you said there's a teacher sample in schools. So what are in full, what are all the groups that you've looked at your app with?
Yeah. So we've worked with, just the general public, like normal, healthy adults. And the one I just mentioned with teachers, it was actually mostly teachers, but also other school employees. So, you know, education professionals. And these days I hesitate to even call a normal group a healthy group, because the truth is we're suffering just as a species. We are suffering. If you just look 100 people off the street, the numbers of people who are struggling with things like depression, anxiety, attention-related disorders, the numbers are just staggering. And they themselves are almost at epidemic levels. So what we call quote-unquote healthy these days, you know, the kind of the norm for our current culture and society is that I think we're all really experiencing challenges to our mental health. And even those who might not be at clinical levels of, you know, depression or anxiety, I think we all know that we're all kind of at the edge. Just the world is so challenging these days, and the pandemic has made it even more challenging. So, it's clear that just as a species, we need help right now, and a lot of people are suffering. But more from a strict scientific point of view, it's been the case that we've kind of gotten a sort of quote unquote normal population, healthy population so far, based on the strong findings we found early on in reducing depression and anxiety and perceived stress. We're actually doing another randomized controlled trial that's going on right now that's with an even larger sample size, but specifically looking at people who actually do have clinical levels of depression and anxiety. And there we're also not only looking at these more mental and emotional factors, but we're measuring the microbiome, so kind of gut flora, and we're also measuring epigenetics, taking kind of a blood spot test, like just from one blood spot, you can get all these amazing data, including epigenetic measures. So we're kind of looking at the biology of these things as well.
And, you know, if that's the case, keeping people engaged for, you know, long periods of time, let's say of their life or as they need it, is really important. And I looked at the attrition rates, and this is, you were making a point in your limitation section that many apps face an issue, which is, you know, consistently using the app, the falling off period. Do you have an idea about when that falling off period is, where, you know, about half the sample might stop using? And then how do we encourage this? Maybe that's one of the key limitations to apps.
It's really, really challenging. You know, in the early days when we were building the app, you know, of course, at the beginning, we didn't know if people would use it or benefit from it at all. And what we heard almost universally, we did a lot of design research, and we worked with this company, IDEO, which is kind of one of the lead design firms on the planet, and learned a lot from them, a tremendous amount from them, just about how to design things well. And what we heard almost universally is similar to what I think a lot of us feel about diet and exercise and things like that. Like, we know we feel better when we're exercising regularly. We know we feel better if we're eating really healthy. And the reality is, it's just hard. It's hard to build healthy habits, even when we feel better doing it. It's just hard. That's the reality. So we heard that from people over and over again. They would say, I love the app. The content was great. I felt so good when I did it. And I just got really busy this weekend, or I had a rough week and I kind of forgot about it, but I'm going to get back to it. We've heard that. I can't even tell you how many times of just that message over and over again. Rarely do people say, oh, I tried it and it just didn't work. I mean, we almost have never heard that. In fact, I don't know if we've ever heard that with, you know, now hundreds of thousands of people have downloaded it. So habit formation is tough. It's a tough nut to crack in terms of building things. I'm sure you know this just in terms of building courses and programs. This is another plus for having a, you know, like an in-person course and guidance. There's something that adds more support that supports the learning process. So it's true. On the one hand, if you look at the data, it's very strong, and you can see that there are these robust effects and improvements on all these different things that we measure. And even we work with a lot of organizations. We have what we call Healthy Minds at Work, which is we've basically adapted the program for workplace settings. And so we work with all these companies, from tiny nonprofits to huge corporations, and we provide them with all those data because we measurement is kind of our bread and butter. And you can see all these improvements. You can see that it's really decreasing stress and burnout in these organizations and improving their sense of purpose and meaning in their work, et cetera. And yet, if you also look at the engagement data, you see exactly what you're saying, which is a lot of the attrition is quite strong. A lot of people do it a little bit and then they kind of taper off. And that's also the reality, which is kind of a paradox. Like, you see such strong data, and then the engagement data is still challenging. So I guess there's two things I would say. One is that even small amounts seem to be beneficial for people. And we've done some data looking, you know, 3 months out or even 6 months out, showing that people who do some training, the benefits seem to persist. Like, we did one training that showed, we trained pre-service school teachers, like students who are in college studying to be teachers. And those who got the training were 6 times more likely to still be teachers 3 years later. You know, a lot of those people probably were not meditating anymore. They had done that training and it probably tapered off. Some of them probably still kept doing it, But that's pretty amazing that it had this huge effect, even financially for the school systems, you know, to not have to be hiring new teachers. So on the one hand, it's not a linear path. You know, I think the reality with learning anything, and almost everybody listening has probably had this experience with exercise or something. It's like you start, you stop, you start, you stop, and maybe eventually it kind of takes hold. But that's not a linear path. It's not like you just flip a switch and then it's just done. That's just the reality of learning something new. So that's one thing I'd say. The other thing I would say is that there's a lot of things we're learning just about how to support healthy habits. So this idea of micro supports I mentioned earlier is one of the things we're very interested in as something that could support people just to stick with things, just little kind of small little nudges throughout the day that just keep it in one's mind. And hopefully that alone will help. And in addition to that, we'll just keep people more engaged with the learning process generally. So we don't know that for sure. This is early days. We're just beginning to test those things. But this question that you're asking about attrition and engagement it's maybe the most challenging part of this, and one we're extremely interested in kind of experimenting and seeing if we can find new ways to help people continue to benefit from these kinds of insights and practices.
Yeah, if only we had some way to use the social media mediums in a way that, like, Instagram and others, you can watch a person or a family member or a friend just scroll forever on a daily basis. And if you think about it that way, it's like shocking. Wait, someone could actually spend hours doing things on their phone, but the things that they might want to do in their own best interests, which is not just scanning, like you're saying, endless information that actually is probably not that pertinent to you in the moment and not going to make you feel great at a later time because a lot of it's comparison. Is there a way that this type, is it too active? Is that why we can't get to that point ever with, like, using apps to be that engaging? Is it like this active versus passive thing, or is there something else?
Yeah, I mean, that's a $1 million question. It's so true. I mean, the amount of time we spend doing things that don't even really feel good. In fact, there actually is interesting research on this. We have this, there's kind of this almost unconscious sense that it's sort of a trade-off between what's really good for us and what feels good. And actually, the research suggests that's sort of a false dichotomy, that if you, like, researchers actually looked in to people's real world behaviors and looked at the things that they derive deep meaning from versus things that are kind of pleasurable in the moment, but not particularly meaningful. And what they found was that, of course, the things that are meaningful are more nourishing, more long-term, but actually they found that the things that are deeply meaningful actually were more pleasurable than the things we do just for pleasure. So it's not even a trade-off. Like, actually we feel not only it leads to better long-term outcomes and we feel we're more aligned with what's important to us, but it's actually even more pleasurable in the short term to do things that are meaningful. But for whatever reason, biologically or who knows, we just have these impulses that oftentimes steer us towards doom scrolling on our phone or whatever. I mean, it doesn't feel good to do that, but yet, you know, we all do it. So, you know, it's I think one of the big design challenges of this era, like how we can use technology as a force for good. In fact, we're working with some big technology companies on exactly those kinds of questions. The thing that makes me hopeful is that, you know, we're not working with all these companies, but the ones we're working with are genuinely interested in this as well. Like, they genuinely see that this can be detrimental to our individual and collective well-being, and they feel the burden of that. You know, we work with, you know, some designers, top designers in the world, who are kind of building these things we use. And it's clear, at least from our experience, that they genuinely want to help people and want to find ways for that to minimize the harm and to emphasize, you know, the good that it can do. And the reality is, we just don't know. Nobody knows. This is just a new frontier. We're going to hopefully have to figure this out as a species if something bad doesn't happen before we get there. But it's a huge challenge.
Yeah, the pull is there. Like, I'll even have personal experiences, like my undergraduate course, and they're finishing up an evaluation. They just have to wait patiently for about 10 minutes for everyone else to finish. And, like, they just can't stop. They're grabbing their phones. I'm like, oh, just 10 minutes, just 9 more minutes. Just grabbing phones, opening computers. It's just, it pulls us in. It's so engrossing, but it's like, why can't we do that same thing? Maybe there's something about brain chemistry I'm not getting here, or there's hidden information that just like the Facebooks and Instagrams of the world just know exactly how to deliver, and it's a slower pull for us to figure out how to do that same thing, but with information. I guess we're still stuck in the information that could support someone's behavior in something like meditation, for those who are interested. But yeah, that
So
would be
true.
amazing. I hope you all figure that one out for sure.
Well,
So
definitely not
what's
going to be us
next?
alone, but hopefully together we can all figure this out because it's going
Yeah,
to be soon.
what's next for Healthy Minds app? Anything on your schedule you're excited about, looking forward?
Yeah, we built the core program, and it's, if you were to do an activity a day, it's almost a year of content. So there's a lot there. And this kind of guided tour through awareness, connection, and insight and purpose. I think now what we're really focused on is taking that core program, and two things. One is this idea of micro supports that I mentioned. So we're really excited about finding, simple ways, even if you can't sit down for a meditation or take 10 minutes out of your day. What are some simple things you can do as you're, just signing on for your fifth Zoom meeting of the day, or you're, driving home from work, or just little, again, little things that can shift the trajectory of your inner experience? That's one thing. And then we're also very interested in creating kind of light adaptations of the program for different populations. So we're just, we did something for college freshmen and sophomores here at the University of Wisconsin, and we created a version of the app. It's kind of the basic version of the app with a light layer of content that's just putting it all in the context of the student experience, just as an example. We created another version for people who are struggling with depression and anxiety. We're exploring doing that for teachers. So we found a way to do it without just a crazy amount of work, to just create a little bit more context so people will see the connections between their lived experience and these practices to cultivate well-being. And then, of course, our hope is to measure that and to see, does that really make a difference? And how can that sense of really making it feel more personal, how that can help, the learning journey. So there's a bunch of other things we're working on too, using machine learning and AI and lots of exciting stuff. But those are a few of the ideas that we're exploring.
Yeah, thank you. And where could people connect with your app, with the website, perhaps, and other related resources?
Well, you can get the app in, in either of the big app stores if you just search Healthy Minds Program. So it's, as we said, it's freely available. There's no, hidden fees. It's not like you get this free and then you got to, pony up a subscription. It's completely free from start to finish. It's powered by donations. So of course, if you use it and want to donate, that's greatly appreciated. So just going into the app store and typing in Healthy Minds Program, is one way. If you're interested in the research, this is all the research is coming out of the University of Wisconsin here in Madison and the Center for Healthy Minds. So the website is centerhealthyminds.org, or you can just Google Center for Healthy Minds and you'll find us. And then the other organization that you mentioned earlier is Healthy Minds Innovations. That's the nonprofit. So that has more information both on the app, our Healthy Minds at Work program, and other things. So again, you can just Google Healthy Minds Innovations. Or go to hminnovations.org and you'll find lots of information there.
Great. Well, thank you for doing this work. I found it useful. I'm using it. So, thank you for your time, Dr. Dahl. Let's conclude for today. You have a wonderful resource here for people, and listeners can find our podcast at GoAmra, GoAmra.org by now.